It's time now for Extra Extra. An inside look at the news from Wicked Local. With your hosts, Caitlin Kelleher and Joy Richard.
Welcome to Extra Extra. I'm Caitlin Kelleher.
And I'm Joy Richard.
Today we're joined by Rob Hannison of the Metro West Daily News, and we're going to talk a little bit about the weather that has been kind of all-consuming our news and will again between Houston and the hurricanes that have been hitting Miami and Florida and the rest of the Keys. Welcome, Rob. Can you tell...
Thanks. Good to have you. Good to be here.
We are here for you, visiting you, actually. Can you tell us a little bit about what you do for the Metro West?
Sure. I'm the deputy director for multimedia for Metro West and Milford. And so I supervise the reporters that are in the Metro West Daily News office and have a hands-on role in managing our Sunday paper, which is our biggest print publication.
Cool. So I've heard that you used to run a weather blog. So can you tell us a little bit about that and where you were doing it and what you were doing?
So I started a blog. It's no longer up, but I started a blog about 10 years ago called The Weather Geek. And part of the reason why I started it was to improve our weather coverage. A lot of times during the winter, you would have snowstorms and people would want to know how much snow fell in my town. And, you mm-hmm. know, this coverage area is very parochial. People who live in one town, they want to know what happened in their town. And so I was trying to figure out a way, how could we get accurate snowfall totals for each snowstorm in all of our communities? So what I did is I started the Weather Geek blog to recruit local readers to come in to become official National Weather Service weather spotters. As well as writing a blog about weather events, because there's always a lot of stuff to write about weather. And I actually got official trainers from the National Weather Service to come out and certify people as hazardous weather spotters in the NOAA network, and they became our official weather spotters for all of our towns. We learned how to properly measure snow, which is actually more complicated than just sticking a ruler in the ground. How to recognize cloud patterns, different other types of weather systems. And they became a great local network of kind of community journalism, reporting how much snow we received. And when we had flooding, they would say, oh yeah, I have a rain gauge too. So this is how much rain we received in Natick or Hopkinton or Sudbury. So it was fun. So it connected the newspaper to the community, but it provided us with a valuable resource.
Yeah, I mean, over the last few weeks or the last few months, I've been able to pull some of those measurements from the National Weather Service because they're now submitting, and those maps of how much snow did they get in my town and where exactly are they always get a ton of page views and interaction and comments.
And it's interesting sometimes the variation that you have, particularly in the Metro West Milford area, where Milford is more southern, it's closer to the Rhode Island border. You know, places like, you know, Bellingham might have significantly less snow than one of our northern towns like Hudson.
Right. And I think altitude also seems to play
into an
issue here. So I know you had mentioned that you guys are talking a little bit about for our stories what is coming up and what your reporters are working on if it happened here. How do you guys assign that kind of story, and when do you decide that national weather story, that national weather pattern issue is something you want to focus on and localize?
I think with what's going on right now with Hurricane Irma and what happened with Hurricane Harvey, I think it's a natural question that readers would have of like, oh, what would happen if something like that happened here? Because we've had some severe weather and some severe storms in the area just in the past 15 years. We had Superstorm Sandy. We had Hurricane Irene that caused a lot of inland flooding. And because Harvey was such an unprecedented storm to, you know, just devastate parts of Houston, and now who knows what's going to happen in Florida. It looks like we know it's going to be bad.
Right. If you look at the reports coming out of the Caribbean and the islands.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think a lot of the question that I think people naturally will have is like, well, what if something like that happened here? The short answer is it's pretty much an impossibility that we would have a hurricane on the level of Harvey or Irma affect us the way it's affecting Florida and Texas. But we don't need it to be that bad for it to be devastating for this region. Typically, when hurricanes and tropical systems come to New England, they're moving very fast. They can have a lot of wind speed. But they also still bring the threat of a lot of inland flooding. There is coastal storm surge. I remember when we were covering Superstorm Sandy, we had up to a week of some areas of, I think, Sudbury and Wayland and the north side of Framingham that had no power because of the amount of tree damage and trees that were down.
Because this area isn't built and isn't maintained to handle a storm.
No.
Like that. So it's like an earthquake.
Yeah.
The more, if it a smaller earthquake here is going to cause a lot more damage
right.
than a larger earthquake in California because of the soil types. And
yeah,
stuff.
And there was a conversation I had this morning with the reporter who's working on the story. We were talking about Hurricane Irene, and I said, you know, the thing to remember is, okay, so Houston got 50 inches of rain, it turned into a giant lake, and eventually drained off. When Hurricane Irene affected the interior parts of New England, you had whole towns in Vermont that were cut off because of elevation. You have rivers that flooded and cut roads in half. So you had towns that had no roads that were left to leave. So you had people who were completely stranded. So that's one of the differences that you see in New England when we have these types of flooding events or big storms. It's different types of hazards. I mean, I think personally, the type of storm that would be something close to a region-wide paralyzing disaster like Harvey and Irma might be for New England would be a really bad widespread ice storm in the middle of winter.
I lived through and reported through the 2008 ice storm that hit the north central part of the state and southern New Hampshire, and my house was out of power for 10 days, and the towns were out for longer than that. I remember covering the town of Westminster where the police department was out of power for 8 days, and the police chief was getting calls from calling National Grid to see if they could get any idea of what time they were going to get the thing, and he goes, they've stopped calling me back on day four. And when the electric company is not calling the police department back, it's a bad sign.
Yeah, I remember that storm. I had to live through that. I mean, I didn't have to work in it because I was working in Framingham, but living in Fitchburg. So it was kind of a going from one part of the world to the other, where you have one area with no power and everything is destroyed, and then you come to Metro West where things were kind of normal.
Yeah.
One of the things with covering that, and this is how I kind of try to guide reporters now when they're covering weather, is a lot of times, particularly for a prolonged disaster, it's difficult to get up-to-date information from people who are trying to do a lot of work to fix things. So oftentimes the best thing to do is just you have to go out and actually find the people instead of relying on phones or relying on some of the traditional ways that you would do your sourcing of calling, you know, the head of a power company. You've got to try and go out and get as much information and do your news gathering from your feet.
Right. That the leather on the ground actually matters at that point.
What's one instance where either you or a reporter was out on the ground that was a really unique way of getting that personal perspective like you were just talking about?
So when I was a reporter in Florida, this was back in the late 90s, we had a tornado come through the area. It was an F3 or an F4 tornado. It was a bad tornado, and I lived in the central part of the state. And it destroyed most of a mobile home park. And one of the ways that I reported on it was we went to the scene, and I was looking around as we got closer, and what I noticed was the closer we got to the area where the tornado touched down, the more stuff you saw up in trees, where there was clothing, there was vinyl siding that was wrapped around trees. And as we got closer to where the tornado was on the ground, you saw more and more personal belongings of people that were just kind of scattered everywhere. And then we eventually found the people, and we talked to them about, you know, how they got through it. It was amazing talking to people who, because these were all people who, most of them were living in mobile homes or small houses, and all that was left for most of these were a slab on the ground. You know, everything was obliterated. It was amazing that nobody was killed. There were a lot of people who were very seriously injured. But talking to people, letting them kind of relive how they survived. I mean, there was one person who jumped in a bathtub. There was a woman, I remember very vividly, a woman telling me about how she woke up, she could hear the tornado coming. She knew afterwards it was the tornado, but she wasn't sure what the noise was. And she remembered, it was because it was in the middle of the night, so it was pitch black. You couldn't hear or see anything. Well, you could hear, but you couldn't see anything. And she remembered stepping out of bed, and when she stepped out of bed, she was in a field. So she wasn't sure if when she was stepping out of bed, the bed was in the air, or if it had already been in the air. But she's like, I remember I sat up, and I was like, oh, what's going on? I should get out of bed. And when I stepped out of bed, my feet landed in the field.
Oh, that's crazy.
And she was completely unharmed, and her house was like hundreds of feet away. So it was an amazing, and she was just like, when we got there, most of the ambulances had already gone through the area, so they had taken everybody who was seriously injured away, and she was like waiting for family to come and kind of like pick her up. And it was a great way to kind of tell a survivor story. And I think I think a lot of times, you see it a lot with TV where people really focus on like devastation and death and, you know, here's what was lost. If you can find survivor stories, if you can find people who can talk about, here's someone who helped me, or here's how I got through this. Those, I think, are the stories that, from a, I guess, a reader psychological perspective, I think they want to read those more than they want to read more about the death and destruction. They'd rather read the survival stories.
So a lot of people ask us why we don't write about the good news.
And that's the good news you can get out of a bad situation, is like, okay, how did you get through this?
All right, and on that note, we're going to take a quick break, and we'll be back. And we're back. This is Caitlin Kelleher and Joy Richards, joined by Rob Hennison of the Metro West Daily News.
So we were talking a little bit about going out into the field and getting the personal stories, the triumphs that come out of tragedy. What are some of the tips that you give to new reporters who are doing that for the very first time, may never have done that? Because it can be very nerve-wracking. And people can also be very raw, and could either go one way. They could either want to spill their guts or be upset. How do you prepare new reporters for doing something like that?
I think preparation is a big part of doing that. And when you can, it's best before the actual disaster happens to try and make some plans of who you can go out with. You know, if you know there's going to be a big snowstorm, that's going to be a paralyzing blizzard. So talk to either the police department or the DPW and say, hey, when the storm hits tomorrow, can I go out and ride with you? So that you have somebody with you who can kind of guide you along of like, oh yeah, when we deal with snowstorms, this is always a problem. But then when you actually encounter people who are in kind of the middle of dealing with whatever has happened to them from a disaster, you know, it's tough to... It's no different, I think, than talking to people after the death of a family member or a friend from a car crash or a fire. You can, you know, you're up front, you tell them, say, listen, I'm a reporter, I'm from the paper. There's going to be a story in tomorrow's paper, or there's going to be a story online today about this. I would like to talk to people who are dealing with this now so we can tell their story and to try to get more of what you're dealing with. You know, maybe it turns into people reaching out and helping you, but it's important for people to know what's going on in the community, and that's what I'm here to do. Sometimes, you know, it's no different when you talk to people who are dealing with a recent death. Sometimes they're going to slam the door in your face, and other times they're going to recognize that it's an opportunity to tell someone's story. Like, if you're covering a natural disaster and somebody has died, it's no different than if it's after a car crash or a fire. What you want to tell them, and this is what I tell every single reporter when they're, especially if they're going out and covering their first death, is when you talk to family or friends, you know, it's perfectly okay to say, you know, I'm sorry for your loss. But at the same time, what you need to tell them is there's going to be a story written about this and written about this person who has died. This is your opportunity to tell readers who this person was, because we would much rather tell that story than how they died. And that, what I found when I was working as a reporter and what the reporters who work here, that phrase, I think, does the trick for a lot of people. And even if they're really still too upset to talk, then you can follow it up with saying, if you're too upset to talk right now, just put me in touch or point me in the direction of somebody here who can, because I really want to be able to tell our readers who this person was. I think people's human nature of wanting to share and wanting to maybe grieve in a communal sense, I think that kicks in at that point. And I think that it also humanizes the reporter who's like, I'm not just here to write about death. They're just like, listen, there's a loss here, and it's important that people understand what that loss is. And I think that is when reporters are put in that position where it's a really tragic situation, but they have an opportunity to get a good story out of it. And yeah, it's good for our readers, and it's good for what we do as a job, but it's also serving a purpose for the people who have lost someone.
Agreed. One of the, you mentioned snow, and New England gets snow, and Massachusetts gets a lot of snow. And how do you think when you're story budgeting or assigning out stories, how do you write something other than the "it snowed again" snow story? Because most of your readers already know that because they looked out their window this morning.
I think one of the things that's important with particularly for winters for snow is numbers. I'm kind of a data geek when it comes to weather reporting. And there's a lot of resources on the National Weather Service website to look at historical numbers for snowfall, for season, for historical year over year, both with online presentation and print presentation. When you're doing graphics that have numbers for snowfall, those are very useful for readers. And it also kind of puts your story in perspective when you're like, yep, it snowed again. Yep, this is the third time it snowed this week. But if you can add into that, we're 47 inches above normal for snowfall this time of year, it puts it in perspective. That's what numbers do.
Right.
What I try to emphasize with reporters is that you can arm and improve your reporting, particularly on weather, with numbers. And you can get those numbers from data files that the National Weather Service has.
And also sometimes comparing those numbers to real things. Like when we got all that snow, my parents live in Virginia, and my mom's a fourth grade teacher at the time. I would take pictures of the snow and pile paper towel rolls on top of each other, because the kids didn't really understand what 26 inches of snow looked like or any of the, but they could look at a paper towel roll and they figured out how much snow we were getting and how much the drifts were.
I forget which newspaper did this. It might have been the Globe or it might have been the Herald. There was one winter where there was a lot of snow, and they had a running graphic of Robert Parrish, who was the center for the Celtics at the time. And he was, I think, 7 feet tall. He might have been 7'1". And they said, how high is the snow on Robert Parrish now for the season? And they kept it going throughout the year. And I think by the end of the year, it was like, you know, you can't see Robert Parrish anymore because he's covered in snow. It was kind of kooky, but it was effective.
Right. And how much water is in a swimming pool? Like, kind of those idea. How much sand, how many tons of sand compared to an elephant type of, because what is 40 tons? I don't have a clue.
And I think when you're in the middle of huge weather events like that, and sometimes they tend to be tragic, you need that like little pop of humor or like little way of thinking, okay, this will go away someday. You know, it's not our constant now. And so I definitely think that helps in those situations. All right, so we're going to take a little bit of a break, and we'll be right back in a few minutes.
We are back, and we are joined by Rob Hannison of the Metro West Daily News. And once kind of the major part of the storm's over, what do you guys look at for follow-up coverage, because for Houston, their newspapers are going to be covering this for days, for months, for years, and they're going to be covering the hurricane damage in Florida for months, for days, for years, as people apply for FEMA loans and towns get reimbursed for money. How do you guys think about those stories, and when do they cycle back into coverage for the Metro West and for the Wicked Locals?
I think a lot of times it's the question that readers have and that we always try to get is cost. You know, everybody wants to know, how much did the snowstorm cost, or how much did the flood cleanup cost? And there are different factors that play into that, whether it's a municipal DPW budget or talking to the state about any sort of disaster aid that's going to help pay for it. With a prolonged disaster and a prolonged cleanup, again, I think it's really important for reporters to get out into the areas that are affected and simply talk to people about, how is this still affecting you? You know, there may be certain parts of your community that are relatively unscathed, and that might be where the reporter sees most things and be like, oh, you know, things aren't too bad. You still have to get out and talk to people, knock on people's doors. If there's cleanup going on, there are a whole bunch of other business angles that you can pursue of businesses that benefit from storm cleanup. You know, what happens after any sort of disaster is there's a boost to the construction industry. And sometimes that involves the chance of scams, of people being, victimized by unscrupulous business people who say they're going to rebuild your roof, and instead they just throw a tarp on it. There are long-term concerns, health concerns, particularly flooding. When you deal with, particularly in New England, you deal with mold, you deal with insurance issues. So, I mean, there are a lot of, I think one of the things that I tell reporters as well is that when you're covering a disaster, try to put yourself in the shoes of the people that it's affecting. And that's where you're going to get your story ideas. That's where you're going to get your continuing news angles to pursue is, okay, picture this person's life throughout their whole day, and how is this affecting them throughout the day? Is it affecting their commute to work? Are their kids going to school? If their kids can't go to school, does that mean that the parents can't go to work because they have to stay home and take care of the kids? How is this affecting work for people who have kids and now they have to stay home? How is it affecting delivery to certain businesses? There's all these different types of angles that you can pursue both during the disaster and afterwards, simply by asking, how is this affecting this person? How is this affecting this other person? Those are stories.
A lot of our reporters are young, and so they may not have families of their own, or at least children of their own. How do you kind of try to make sure that they get into the head of people who are living at home or living with families, young kids, elderly, because that's not the perspective that they're coming at the world from?
Yeah. Again, it's a matter of going out and talking to the people. And it's completely okay for a young reporter to tell someone, I don't have any kids, or I don't own a house, so I don't understand. I don't have firsthand knowledge of some of the challenges that you might be facing right now during this attack. Please tell me about that. What, how is this affecting you? Because it's not firsthand knowledge that I would have, because I don't have to deal with those things. That's perfectly okay. I've always told reporters, it's okay to ask questions that make you look stupid. I said, because what you're doing is you're making the other person feel empowered, because they're telling you something that you obviously think is important and you don't know. You're giving them temporary expert status. People like that.
They do. And I think I've asked a lot of questions that make me feel stupid through the course of my career. When you were working in Florida, what was one of the major storms? I mean, clearly the tornado was significant, but what other types of storm coverage did you get?
We had a really significant wildfire that burned most of the central part of the state where I was living in for months. It went on for months. It was mostly in the swamps. But the problems with that is it blocked certain roads. At one point, I-75, which is one of the main roads that goes through Florida, was closed because there were flames leaping over it. And they were bringing in smoke jumpers from the Southwest, so from Arizona and New Mexico.
And smoke jumpers are?
Smoke jumpers are people who go up in airplanes and parachute into wildfire zones to help put out wildfires. So I went up in a plane with some of these people with a photographer to shoot some aerial footage and just get an idea of how big the fire was. It's one of the few times that I've felt airsick. I didn't actually throw up, but I really felt like I could have, because we were in a very small plane that was circling in a very tight circle above the fire, and the plane was filling up with smoke from the fire. And it was a very cool perspective, because the bomber plane that was going in to dump the flame retardant was going below us. So we got like a bird's eye perspective as it was going in on the bombing run to dump the flame retardant. I also spent time on the ground with smoke jumpers out in the, while they were putting out the fire and
did
stuff like
that.
I did not jump. I've jumped out of planes before, but I didn't do it that day.
Of course you have.
And the thing that was really, and again, this is an idea, this is another reason why it's important to be there for this. So one of the stories I did was about who these smoke jumpers were. And a lot of them were Native Americans who were coming from reservations out in New Mexico and Arizona, and they were deathly afraid of alligators. So they had this whole system worked out, because you would be out in the middle of the swamp and you had to get water to put out a fire. And they had these backpacks that could siphon water out of ponds that were out in the middle of the woods. But most of those ponds had alligators in them. And they were deathly afraid of alligators. So they had the whole system worked out where it was like a 5-person operation, where one person would stand on either side of the person who would be by the edge of the water while he was filling up his backpack with water. The other person would have his hand on his belt to pull him out of harm's way if an alligator were to come by the edge of the water. And the fifth person was back with an axe to hit the alligator if it did actually come out of the water. While we were talking about this, we're driving down the road in the back of a big like army truck, and an alligator is walking down the side of the road in the middle of the forest. It's like a fire access road. And they're like, see, that's what we're talking about. They're walking around everywhere. And they were walking around everywhere. And that was another story I did, because it was a severe drought in Central Florida, and that's part of the reason why the swamp lit on fire, is because it was just way too dry. And that forced the alligators to move out of the swamp and walk around a lot. And so they were ending up in people's neighborhoods, and it's another reason to try and get out with the people who are actually doing it. You know, it's kind of that whole idea of like embedding journalism.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty amazing, the idea that a swamp, which you think is completely soaked, can catch fire. And I would assume that the fire goes down into the roots of the trees. How did they tell you that they fought something like this, and how long did it take for them to finally finish fighting these fires?
It went on for a couple of months. It was a couple of months of news coverage. And you're right, it was the peat in the swamp dried out. So it was, you know, several feet down. And the way the swamps are in Florida is you have, it's very flat, and then you have these islands of mostly pine trees, and those explode when they catch fire. So you would be standing back, and the fire would get up in the trees, and you could see the tree explode, and the fire would jump from tree to tree. So basically what they did is it was try to contain the fire using bulldozers and guys on the ground with pickaxes and shovels, trying to contain the fire within a certain area by digging down. You had to dig down several feet and bring a bulldozer in where you could to try and encircle the fire and try to keep it to one area. And then we got a week of rain, and that took care of it.
I mean, you had to watch for your safety in that situation. When our reporters are out in this area during a superstorm Sandy or a blizzard or an ice storm, we all have to be careful about our safety. What advice do you give reporters, and when do you make the call to say, all right, all the photographers and reporters have to come in and come out of the storm and stuff like that?
Yeah, I mean, especially around here for snowstorms where it's difficult and dangerous to drive on the roads, it's good to plan ahead of, you know, try to figure out when you can get out and make your own best decision on when it's time to get off the roads. You know, personal safety is something everybody should place a high priority on, whether you're a reporter or anything else. And that means having good tires on your car. That means making sure that you have, you know, adequate clothing with you, making sure your phone is charged. You know, there's those, you know, basic rules of personal safety that people, but as far as saying, okay, you know, when does it become too dangerous to do your job? You know, that's each person's, you know, personal call, but you know, you don't put yourself in harm's way. You know, when I was in the military, I was a medic, and one of the first rules of being a medic is you're no good if you're dead.
That, well, there was a letter that went out to the, I think the Miami Herald or staff that said, takes us too many, you're not good to us dead. We have a hiring freeze. We can't fill your position. I mean, they put a really light tone on it, but they basically said, don't die. Don't be the person standing in the water and get electrocuted.
And that's where, ahead of time, if you can arrange to be with somebody who knows what they're doing, so if you know you're going to cover a blizzard the next day, call the DPW and say, is there a plow driver I can ride in the cab with? A, they're going to love that. And B, that reporter is going to be safe because they're in a really big vehicle that has chains on it. But, you know, it's no different when you get to a scene and, you know, don't rush into a scene where there might be electrical wires on the ground or, you know, the house is on fire and, you know, maybe it's going to fall on you or something like that. You know, show some common sense. But planning ahead, again, is another, you know, when I went out with the smoke jumpers on the ground into the swamp, mm-hmm. you know, I made sure ahead of time, I said, okay, you know, we, myself and the photographer, we had to dress in those big flame retardant wool outfits, which are so comfortable in 90 degrees in Florida.
We had in the middle of a fire, which you know is so cool usually.
Yeah, and we had to have helmets on. We had to have boots. I remember the photographer, she had to go out and buy boots because she's like, I don't have any big boots that like work boots that would work for this. And they're like, we can't let you out there because the National Forestry Service was in charge of the fire at that point. And they said, we can't let you out there unless you meet these certain safety standards. So it's just trying to be prepared and try to plan ahead of time.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us on this episode. I am Caitlin Kelleher. You can follow me on Twitter at CM Kelleher or email me at ckelleher@wickedlocal.com.
And I'm Joy Richard. You can follow me on Twitter at Extra Extra Joy or send me an email at jrichard@wickedlocal.com.
And Rob, where can people find you and the stories that the Metro West does?
So I'm on Twitter at Rob_Hanesmw. It's HaneisenMW on Twitter. And you can see all of our stories at MetroWestDailyNews.com.
Great. Thank you very much. Thanks for starting your week with us.
Thank you.
You can join Caitlin and Joy as they go behind the scenes each week at Wicked Local. Follow Caitlin on Twitter at CM Kelleher and Joy at Extra Extra Joy. Thank you for listening to Extra Extra.
Extra Extra, read all about it. Extra Extra, read all about it.